Lacking true blood, the Krenken could not balance their collar properly with a sanguine humor. Instead, they possessed a yellow-green ichor. But as he was no doctor of the medical arts, Dietrich was uncertain which humor the ichor might govern, perhaps one unknown to Galen. "But no worries," he told Hans. "The haycocks will be loaded into the carts again next mowing season, but the Gartners will do so not from duty but from charitas, or for a fee for the added labor."
"Charity?"
"Yeah. To seek the good of another, and not your own."
"You do so?" Question.
"Not as often as the good Herr commanded, but yes. It gathers merit for us in heaven."
"Does the Heinzelmanken overset correctly?" Question. "A superior being came from the heaven, made himself your Herr, and ordered that you perform this charity?"
"I would not phrase it so."
"Then all fits."
Dietrich waited, but Hans said nothing more. The silence lengthened and waxed oppressive, and he had begun to suspect that his stealthy visitor had stolen away. The Krenken were not long on the formalities of greeting and farewell, when Hans spoke once more.
"I will say now a thing, though it shows us weak. We are a mixed folk. Some belong to the ship, and its captain was their Herr. The captain died in the shipwreck, and Geschert now rules. Others form a school of philosophers whose task is to study new lands. It was they who hired the ship. The Kratzer is not their Herr, but the other philosophers allow him to speak for them."
"Primus inter pares," Dietrich suggested. "First among equals."
"So, a useful phrase. I will tell him. In the third band are those who travel to see strange and distant sights, places where the well-known have lived, or where great events have happened. What call you such folk?"
"Pilgrims."
"So, the ship was to visit several places favored by pilgrims before bearing the philosophers onward to a new-found land. The ship's company and the school of philosophers say always that on such journeys into the unknown there may be no return. It has happened, it will happen."
"Ja, doch," Dietrich said. "In my father's time some Franciscan scholars sailed with the brothers Vivaldi to seek India, which Bacon's map placed but a short distance westward across the ocean sea. But nothing was again heard of them after they departed Cape Non."
"Then you have the same sentence in your head. A new journey may fare one way. But in the pilgrims' heads there stands always a return. And our failure to reach the correct heaven must be from someone's, I think your word is, sin. So some pilgrims place our present failure on Geschert's sin. And even some of the ship's company say that he is nothing beside he who was captain before. One thinking himself stronger may seek to replace him. And if so, Geschert will likely raise his neck, for it is in my head that he may think the same."
"It is a grave matter," Dietrich said, "to overthrow the established order. For who is to say but the result may not be worse? We had such an uprising 12 years ago. An army of peasants laid waste the countryside, burning manor houses, killing lords and priests and Jews." And Dietrich recalled with sudden, unbearable immediacy the swirling intoxication of being swept along by something greater and more powerful and more right than oneself, the safety and arrogance of numbers. He remembered noble families immolated inside their own houses, Jew moneylenders paid in full with hemp and faggot. There had been a preacher among them, a man of some learning. And he had exhorted the crowds with the words of James. "Woe to you rich! Your wealth has rotted, your fine wardrobe is moth-eaten. Your gold and silver has tarnished, and their corrosion is a testament against you.
Here, crying aloud, are the wages you withheld from the serfs who worked your fields. The cries of the harvesters have reached the ears of the Lord. You lived in wanton luxury on the earth. You fatten yourselves for the day of slaughter.
And the Armlader army, it called itself an army with self-proclaimed captains and wore leather brassards for livery. Sweaty, lust-mad, impatient for loot, foreboding their own death warrants, would join in the last, so that the shout, "Day of slaughter!" hoarse from a thousand throats, were the last words many a wealthy lord or Jew heard in this life. Manor houses lit the night with their flames, so that a man might travel the Rhineland by their illumination as if by day. Merchant wagon trains plundered by the roadside. Itinerant peddlers, promoted by hue and cry to cosmopolitan Jew moneylenders, torn apart. Freetown burghers fled within ancient walls, watching from the parapets while their guild halls and warehouses burned. But burg walls had withstood the undisciplined mobs, and rage faded to a realization that now only the gibbet awaited. From stone citadels had poured forth a river of steel. Hares and knights, armsmen and guild militias and feudal levies, lances and halberds and crossbows, hacking and piercing flesh and bone. Coursers swifter than the most eager of flying heels. A ragtag of farm implements, clubs, knives, billhooks thrown down by the roadside. Chivalry in mail coats riding down the peasants, lacking so much as breeches beneath their smocks, so that they littered the highways with the shit and piss of their terror, and showed their shriveled privates as they dangled from every tree limb in the Elsass and the Breisgau.
Dietrich became aware of the silence.
"Thousands perished," he told the Krenk abruptly. The Krenk was silent still. In the quiet, the wood of the church groaned.
Dietrich said, "Hans?"
"The Kratzer was wrong. Our folk are very different."
Hans leapt from roof beam toward the rear of the church, and then up into the clerestory where a window stood open.
"Hans, wait!" Dietrich cried. "What mean you?"
The creature paused at the open window and turned its gaze on Dietrich.
"Your peasants killed their lords. That is an unnatural thing. What we are, we are. We have this sentence in our heads from those animals who were our ancestors."
Dietrich, dumbstruck at this offhand pronouncement, found his voice only with difficulty.
"You number animals among your ancestors?"
He imagined foul couplings with beasts, women lying with dogs, men futtering donkeys.
What might be born of such unions?
Something unspeakable, something monstrous.
"In ancient times," the Krenk replied, "there gave creatures like your honeybees in the divisions of their labor. They had no sentences inside their heads to tell them their duties. Instead, the sentences were written into the atoms of their flesh, and these atoms were passed from sires and dams to their offspring, and so after an age to us. So do each of us know our besitting in the great web. So it was, so it is." Dietrich trembled. All beings desiring their proper end move toward it by nature, so a stone being earth moved naturally toward the earth, and a man loving the good moved naturally toward God. But in animals, the appetites are moved by the estimative power, which rules despotically, while in men they are moved by the cognitive power which rules politically. So the sheep esteems the wolf as enemy and runs without thinking, but a man may stand his ground or flee as his reason suggests. Yet if the Kranken were ruled by instinctus, the rational appetite could not exist in them, since a higher appetite necessarily moved a lower one. Which meant that the Kranken were beasts. Memories of talking bears and talking wolves enticing children to their doom flickered in his memory. That the being in the rafters above him was no more than a beast that spoke,
terrified Dietrich beyond measure, and he fled from Hans, and Hans fled from him.